Today, I would like to talk about vocation, probably more about work than vocation. And this might seem an odd topic in relation to yesterday's presentations. For those of you who weren't here, I won't ask to embarrass you by a show of hands. But we talked about worship, particularly about why Presbyterian worship is odd, and there are good reasons and bad reasons for that. And I wound up talking a fair amount about the importance of the sermon and why Presbyterians emphasize sermons as much as we do in worship. And then the second lecture was about the liturgical calendar and why Presbyterians don't follow the church calendar, the cycle of seasons, Lent, Advent, Christmas, Holy Week, etc. And I was making the case that actually Presbyterians do have their own church calendar, which is the week. Every Sunday is the beginning of a week, and there's a cycle of holidays that we follow. Every Sunday we stop, rest from our labors, and enter into worship. And that in itself is its own calendar with its own, I think, integrity, and points to the importance of worship in the life of a believer. So that's what I was considering yesterday. But actually, that point about the importance of the week also, then I got to quit pounding the pulpit. I'm not a pulpit pounder, but I don't even pound the lectern in the classrooms at Hillsdale. Why am I doing this? But the importance of thinking about the week as opposed to the solar year or the lunar calendar, which each are ways that we mark time. We also mark time by the week. And that does point to today's topic, which is vocation and work. And this reminded me, in thinking about this morning, going over my notes, there was a time back 20 years ago when I met the Montgomerys, and I don't know if they were following these debates, but John Frame, a professor then at Reformed Seminary, I guess he was in California at that point, but he was leaving soon for RTS Orlando, was writing about worship and contemporary worship and worship, contemporary worship music. And he was making the case that all of life is worship, that the idea of simply narrowing our understanding of worship to consider what happens on Sunday or in worship services and what's the pattern of worship in the order of our services was too constrained and narrow. He wanted to see all of life as worship. And there's a sense in which that's right, but there's also a sense in which that needs a major qualification, which brings me to the topic today, which is vocation and work. And I think it is possible to see what we do during the week in our work, our secular callings, as it were. We can see that as worship, as something by which we glorify God and serve Him, just as we glorify God and serve Him in worship services. But this work is a function of glorifying God via the means of creation versus worship on Sunday glorifying God via the means of redemption. And keeping the distinction between redemption and creation seems to me is really important, and oftentimes what gets missed when all through all sorts of Christian expressions these days, there's an effort to try to integrate all of life into one thing under Christ's reign or something. But you still have to pay attention, it seems to me, to the difference between creation and salvation or creation and redemption. Christ is Lord of both, but Christ executes his work as creator and or as redeemer very differently. And so in some ways, I think this, what I want to say today, it does go with worship, but it's not as it's certainly not about worship on Sunday. It's about worship we may do during the week or how we think about our work. So I want to begin by thinking about the Reformation and vocation and the way that the Reformation recovered or even instituted, but probably more recovered from biblical and ancient church notions, the idea of what it means to serve God in the world. Vocation still can mean, in Roman Catholic circles, simply having a religious calling, being, they call them the religious. Monks and nuns are the religious. And priests have a vocation. And of course, you can go from priest to Monsignor to bishop, etc. So they reserve the word vocation typically for people engaged in full-time Christian ministry, which is what my upbringing would have called it, people engaged in religious work explicitly. So they didn't really have a category for thinking about vocation in the secular world. The rule of Saint Benedict, the Benedictine rule, as it were, and one of the chief vehicles for thinking about monasticism, which originated somewhere in the 6th century, Benedict wrote, "Let a man consider that God is always looking at him from heaven, that his actions are everywhere visible to the divine eyes and are constantly being reported to God by the angels. In order that he may be careful about his wrongful thoughts, therefore let the faithful brother say constantly in his heart, 'Then shall I be spotless before him if I have kept myself from iniquity.'" And monasticism, then, the Benedictine rule, is to way to preserve yourself from iniquity, but it also means separating yourself from the world and devoting yourself to a life of poverty, chastity, and obedience. And there are all sorts of rules to develop. Monasticism is a huge part of the medieval world, and it is a way of pursuing salvation in that part of Christian history. And there are still people, Roman Catholics today, who write about monasticism as a valuable way to pursue Christian life. Eventually, monks would take on various work in the secular world, and monasteries were a big part of the medieval economy in ironic ways. Agricultural production, law, teaching, art, music, cooking, owning of lands. When the Reformation comes, kings like Henry VIII take lands away from monasteries because there was great wealth in the land. So it wound up being something that wasn't particularly sacred or ascetic and much more worldly, as it were. But still, the ideal behind this is an understanding that in order to pursue salvation, you have to separate yourself from the world. And this was probably a reigning idea for 1,000 years in Christian history, between 500 roughly and 1500. and the Roman Catholic Church, which absorbs in the early Middle Ages, absorbs learning from antiquity, the Greek and Roman worlds, they got a great boost for this understanding of the separated life or monasticism from the ancient Greeks and Greek philosophy. In the ancient Greek world, any form of work was considered an unmitigated evil to be avoided at all costs. The goal of life was to leave time for the pursuit of philosophy and leisurely contemplations of the good. So there's a hierarchy in the Greek world that the people who have leisure, have means, have opportunity, would devote themselves not to work and service, but to thinking grand thoughts. And Aristotle has a whole section of his Nicomachean Ethics talking about the virtue of the contemplative life. So, and this idea of the contemplative life dovetails really well with monasticism, where you want to leave yourself, leave the world, and go into some kind of pursuit of the good, the true, the beautiful, which is a cliche that we use too much at Hillsdale, in my estimation. I hope no one from Hillsdale is listening. But it's a very otherworldly understanding. You remove yourself from, not otherworldly, but from secular pursuits, from common activity, and devote yourself to something higher or sacred. Thomas Aquinas wrote in the 13th century, "The contemplation of divine truth is the goal of the whole of human life. Work which meets the needs of the body then has no lasting significance." So again, you have these different ways of thinking about work and salvation, which set up this juxtaposition between work in the world and salvation, and monasticism is one of the fruits of that. And it also has a great consequence then for people who are living in that system, people who aren't religious, people who are ordinary believers working in various kinds of work in the world, that their work is somehow suspect. It's not, certainly not holy, but it may even be somehow unseemly, maybe worldly, maybe even wicked in some way, something that's necessary but not really to be recommended. And this is part of the reason why the Reformation is such a great breakthrough to cut through this understanding, not only Rome's understanding of salvation, as far as justification by faith alone and not relying upon our works to please God, but then also, it's kind of an irony that if we abandon our works to please God, we rest entirely upon Christ. Now somehow you're liberated to do work in the world, to do the sorts of things that used to be looked down upon. But one of the reasons why Protestants did recover the doctrine of work or vocation, sort of using those interchangeably, the short answer is not this time, Jesus is not the right answer, although it could be. The right answer this time is the Bible. They read the Bible. And it's striking when you read the Bible how much work in the world is either explicit or implicit. How much, and this is kind of getting ahead of myself with one of the points I want to make, but how much work is basic to being human? You can't be human and not work. Seemingly, although with the, what is it, the UBI, the what is that thing where people are going to get paid $1,000 a month? Universal basic. Yeah, UBI was the right. I get that confused with DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion. Although if you reversed E and I, you'd get DIE, diversity, inclusion, and equity. And DEI is, isn't that Latin for God? Dei? So Proverbs is one place where you can find a lot of instruction about work, obviously. I'll run through some of these. Proverbs 10:4, a slack hand causes poverty. And it's also intriguing that coincidental, providential, that we were reading about the Eighth Commandment, which also implies work. In the positive, the question and answer 74 before what we read today, even memorized today. But Proverbs 10:4, a slack hand causes poverty, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. Proverbs 19:24, the sluggard buries his hand in the dish and will not even bring it back to his mouth. That's not good. Proverbs 26:15, the sluggard buries his hand in the dish. It wears him out to bring it back to his mouth. Oh my. And then we get the Proverbs 31 woman, 31:13. She seeks wool and flax and works with willing hands. 16, she considers a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hands, she plants a vineyard. 19, she puts her hands to the distaff and her hands hold the spindle. 20, she opens her hand to the poor and reaches out her hands to the needy. 31, give her of the fruit of her hands and let her works praise her in the gates. So there's a lot of recommendation of work in Proverbs, the kind of ordinary work that ordinary people were doing during the Middle Ages. So you could argue that the Reformation is kind of secularizing ordinary life, or at least some might say sacralizing, but and we have to keep those categories distinct. But still, it's opening up a world and giving it recognition and value that the Roman Catholic Church had not, by creating this kind of hierarchy of the religious people who do religious work from ordinary people who do ordinary work. Genesis 1:28 is another important part. The whole creation narrative is actually hugely significant for thinking about work and work being part of what it means to be human. Genesis 1:28 reads, God blessed them. God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And part of that dominion is cultivation of all sorts of things. involves work in the world. Genesis 2:15 reads, "The Lord God took man, took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it." So the original work that Adam was given, aside from naming things, was also to work. He was a gardener. He was a farmer. So there's that. But it's also true in the New Testament. Paul writes, Ephesians 4:28, "Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor," which goes along with the Eighth Commandment today, "doing honest work with his own hands so that he may have something to share with anyone else." That sharing with anyone else is also useful to consider, and I'll do that in a few minutes under the category of providence. 1 Corinthians 4:11, Paul writes, and this is often part of his just general instructions to the churches as he's winding up his letters, "and to aspire to live quietly and to mind your own affairs and to work with your hands as we instructed you." So this is just part of being a Christian, part of being human is to work. 2 Corinthians 3:10, "For even when we were with you, we would give you this command. If anyone is not willing to work, let him not eat." Ouch. Or 2 Corinthians 3:11, next verse, "For we hear that some among you walk in idleness, not busy at work, but busy bodies." So Paul thinks that work is just part and parcel of what people are called to do. And then one of my favorites, maybe is too strong, but I think it's worth turning to this part in the Bible, in Paul's instruction, 1 Timothy 5, which is a passage that I call attention to it, particularly because in a lot of contemporary churches, more progressive, even conservative Presbyterian churches, this is a passage that people who want to turn diaconal ministry into some kind of welfare, support for welfare, programs by the government, may get a little ahead of themselves. So Paul writes here, this is about how to take care of widows, 1 Timothy 5:9. "Let a widow be enrolled if she is not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one husband, and having a reputation of good works, if she has brought up children, has shown hospitality, has washed the feet of the saints, has cared for the afflicted, has devoted herself to every good work." Notice there are strings attached to whether she's going to get welfare. She has to have been a pretty good person. "But refuse to enroll younger widows, for when their passions draw them away from Christ, they desire to marry, and so incur condemnation for having abandoned their former faith. Besides that, they learn to be idlers, going about from house to house, and not only idlers, but gossips and busybodies, saying what they should not. So I would have younger widows marry, bear children, manage their households, and give the adversary no occasion for slander." So again, there's an implicit recommendation of work for these younger women, that they're going to marry, manage their households, do all that Proverbs 31 stuff, because that's going to keep them from this other bad stuff, which is being busybodies, slanderers, gossips, and the like. But again, the reason why I brought that up in part is, and it's worth paying attention to, is that if you want to think about what the church does diaconally, the church does have, should have, conditions for who it supports. I mean, it's a spiritual calling. It's a real act of discernment to figure out when to support people, how to help people sort through their financial needs and the like. But there is clear instruction here from Paul that it's not just, oh, you come, you need something, boom, we'll give it to you. Open check policy. No, there are going to be certain restrictions, and there are also ways to encourage people to provide for themselves as much as possible. So that's something also to keep in mind. But generally speaking, the point here being that the Reformers recovered biblical teaching about the importance and of work, the nature of being human, and how much work is part of the human experience or being human. One other little wrinkle here before turning from the Reformation, well, not turning from it, but thinking about business and economics at the time of the Reformation. It is another irony that what kicked off the Reformation was the sale of indulgences in Germany. That's what got Luther's attention in particular. How could you sell forgiveness, which is what an indulgence is? The church thinks it has a treasury of merits somewhere in the Vatican. There's a big treasury and there are merits in there. And they still grant indulgences. People don't have to pay for them, but they do have to do certain things to get a full indulgence, which can be applied to someone in purgatory, and that gets them fewer years in purgatory or out of purgatory. But John Tetzel was selling these indulgences in Germany. Luther didn't like that money in Germany was going to Italy to support the building of St. Peter's Basilica. And there's a kind of German nationalism kind of brewing here, and you still see remnants of this, not only in Protestant time, but today with the German bishops are very much suspicious at times of the Vatican. But Luther rejects that and wants to find a way of, and clear teaching of Scripture for understanding salvation and forgiveness independent of some kind of financial arrangement, or independent even of whether the Pope can grant forgiveness in that way to people who are deceased of all things. And with that came the business of the Reformation itself, another little wrinkle of irony here, that when Luther starts to write, the printing business, the printing press has been around about 80 years at this point, movable type, great innovation in the history of books and publication. But the pamphlet literature that's taking off in the 1520s, circulating Luther's ideas and then people reacting to it, is a boon to publishers and distributors and booksellers. They're like little pamphlets. It's almost like when you look at the history of the way that this printing industry took off with these small pamphlets, it's almost like the early days of the internet. Websites just popping up and people reading stuff and information going out. Not disinformation, but information. And so there's even the Reformation itself contributes to the business enterprises of people who are doing legitimate work of publishing, even though the Roman Catholic Church also, at the Second Vatican Council, tries to clamp down on that kind of publishing, so that in Roman Catholic territories, at least, you need to get the approval of the bishop if you're going to print certain sorts of documents. But speaking of Luther, what did Luther himself say about vocation? Some of these quotations, I guess I should have had a handout, but I didn't prepare one. So pardon these quotations, but they're Luther, so they're really good. They're oftentimes funny, a little poignant, maybe a little earthy. But among the things that Luther wrote about vocation and work, he writes, "All the duties of Christians, such as loving one's wife, rearing one's child, governing one's family, obeying the magistrate, etc., which the Roman Catholics regard as secular and fleshly, are fruits of the Spirit. These blind men do not distinguish between vices and things that are good creatures of God." So he's already there noticing this hierarchy of work and activity in the world, and Luther's very much rejecting that hierarchy, that the ordinary things that people do, just paying taxes, obeying the magistrate, taking care of families, is good and wholesome because it's created by God. He also writes, "It looks like a great thing when a monk renounces everything and goes into the cloister, carries on a life of asceticism, fasts, watches, prays, etc. On the other hand, it looks like a small thing when a maid cooks and cleans and does other housework. But because God's command is there, even such a small work must be praised as service of God, far surpassing the holiness and asceticism of all monks and nuns." Hear that, ladies? Hear that, mothers? He's affirming you, and your work is even better than any kind of monk. Maybe even better than yours at times, Pastor Montgomery. And he also thought about, say, something as dicey as being a soldier. You know, and we could talk for a while, perhaps about the way Americans regard the military. And generally speaking, Americans don't need to be encouraged to view the military highly. But Luther is aware that there are problems with regarding the military highly, because wars often involve great calamity and destruction of life and property, as we're thinking about when we read headlines coming out of Ukraine, for instance. But Luther did still recommend that being a soldier and engaging in that kind of work was good. And here's how he did it. Now, although it does not seem, indeed, that slaying and robbing is a work of love, whence a simple man may think that it is not a Christian work and beseems not a Christian to do, yet in truth, it is, after all, a work of love. And here he's talking about now doctors, so don't get too caught up with that. For a good physician, when the disease is so deep and virulent that he has to cut off and destroy hand, foot, eye, or ear in order to save the body, seems, when we consider the limb that he cuts off, a terrible and merciless man, yet considering the body that he tries to save, he is in truth an excellent, faithful man and is doing a good Christian work to the best of his ability. So he uses that as the analogy now for thinking about war and soldiers. Even so, when I consider the work of war, punishing the wicked, slaying wrongdoers, and causing so much misery, it seems to be a very unchristian work and directly contrary to Christian love. But when I consider how it protects the good, women and children, homes, property, and honor, and sustains and preserves the peace with all, then it appears how precious and divine the work is. And I see that it too cuts off an arm or a leg to save the whole body. For if the sword did not keep the peace and prevent riot, would needs ruin everything in the world. Therefore, such a war is nothing else than a small and brief breach of the peace to prevent a long and limitless breach of the peace. So this is kind of just war theory, thinking how you, the value of war in order to preserve peace and justice in the world. And Luther even wrote prayers for soldiers about to go into war, which are really quite stunning and moving. But it's also important to see that Calvin did not differ from Luther on this. Luther was, he was about 30 years, roughly, 25 years older than Calvin. Luther born 1483, I'm pretty sure, Calvin 1509. So Calvin would have been a second-generation reformer. So Luther got to say a lot of this stuff before Calvin did. Calvin wasn't even a Protestant until about 1534. Luther's already been writing as a Protestant for about at least 13 years, depending how you date his experience. But still, Calvin echoes Luther when he writes about vocation or work. And here from his commentary on Luke 10, which is one of the texts used to support monastic life. It's Jesus visiting with Mary and Martha. And I always forget which one's working and which one's not working. But, you know, one of them isn't working. She wants to be at Jesus' feet. And that's the example that people advocating monasticism would say, see, that's the better path. That's what you should do. And Calvin says, that's the wrong application of the text. How absurdly, he writes, have they perverted the works of Christ to support their own contrivance, will appear manifest when we have ascertained the natural meaning. Luke says that Mary sat at the feet of Jesus. Does he mean that she did nothing else throughout her whole life? On the contrary, the Lord enjoins his followers to make such distribution of their time that he who desires to make proficiency in the school of Christ shall not always be an idle hearer, but shall put in practice what he has learned. For there is a time to hear and a time to act. It is therefore a foolish attempt of the monks to take hold of this passage as if Christ were drawing a comparison between a contemplative and an active life, while Christ simply informs us for what end and in what manner he wishes to be received. There are times to be at Jesus' feet. That would be the Lord's day. There are times to be working, like Martha was. I think I got that right, Martha. So this idea then, it's part of the Reformation and part of the recovery of the gospel, as I mentioned, is that being freed from our sin and being freed from dependence upon our works to justify us before God frees us also then to work in the world, and even to work in ways that we were created to do. So this leads then to a point about which I mentioned at the beginning, about the importance of creation and where human beings fit in that, and the kind of activity, what human beings were actually called to do in the created order. And this is where work and vocation go hand in hand. Vocation, it's not as if any of us have any one vocation. I'm a husband, I'm a professor, I'm an elder. I used to serve on the public library committee. I'm the president of the Mencken Society, woohoo. I mean, I have a variety of activities and professional responsibilities and personal or private responsibilities. All of you have those as well. Those are all vocations. It's not like I'm just a professor, or I'm just a husband, or I'm just an elder. I have to juggle all those things. And that's part of, again, one of the things we were talking about yesterday. It's hard to be reformed. It's hard to juggle all those things and sort them out and prioritize and make sure you get all that work done. But it is still important to see that more generally human beings are called, have a big V vocation attached to them, because we are called to work because that's the way God created us and the way he created the whole world. So to make this point, if you turn to Psalm 8, there are many psalms about creation and the created order, but this is one of them, and it's relatively short to make the point. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babes and infants, you have established strength because of your foes to still the enemy and the avenger. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him? So human beings look kind of insignificant when you look at the heavens. I still look at the moon many times and marvel that human beings ever set foot on that. It's just an amazing accomplishment, especially with technology being what it was then, basically computers and duct tape, very low grade. I don't know how they did that. But still, that's one impression you can get from just looking at the created order, or if you look at mountains out in the west or even mountains in the east, such as they are. Yet it goes on, yet you have made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor. You have given him dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen and all the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens and the fish of the sea, whatever passes along the paths of the seas. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. So there you see this special place reserved for human beings in this incredibly vast, wonderful created order, and yet human beings have this dominion over at least this part of the universe in the world. And it's an amazing thing to think about human beings in that light. But basic to being human there also is to have dominion. And that means caring, cultivating, doing all sorts of work. And it doesn't always mean working with your hands. It may mean managing other people who do this. So it doesn't necessarily mean you have to read Wendell Berry and go out and buy a farm. But still, there is work involved in all the sorts of things that make society go. And this relates, so that's sort of the doctrine of creation, but it's also creation and providence very much go together. So I'd encourage you to turn to the back of your hymnal, to the Confession of Faith, for a nice summary of what providence is. This is chapter 5 of the Confession, I believe. I'll make sure. And I think it is on page 920. 922, chapter 5. The first three paragraphs here. God, the great creator of all things, I'm going to go with the modern version, does uphold, direct, and dispose and govern all creatures, actions, and things from the greatest even to the least by his most wise and holy providence according to his infallible knowledge and the free and immutable counsel of his own will to the praise of the glory of his wisdom power, justice, goodness, and mercy. So God governs all things. This is what providence in part includes. God doesn't simply create and then back away, but God continues to govern, direct, dispose, uphold all things. But it goes on, although in relation to the foreknowledge and decree of God, the first cause, all things come to pass immutably and infallibly, yet by the same providence he orders them to fall out according to the nature of second causes, either necessarily, freely, or contingency. God, in his ordinary providence, makes use of means, yet is free to work without, above, and against them at his pleasure. Yesterday we were talking a lot about the means of grace, about word, sacrament, and sacraments and prayer as means of sustaining us in our spiritual life. Here we have also a mention again of means and secondary causes that God uses to provide for his creation. And the work of human beings is part of that provision, taking dominion over creation, cultivating fields, managing businesses, selling stuff, educating children, etc. That's all part of God's providence of caring for his creation. It's amazingly complex understanding of creation and the ways in which God, through these secondary means, takes care of his creation. But the work of human beings is crucial to that. And we saw that especially for 2 years, or at least a year and a half during the pandemic, when somehow people thought you could flick a switch and turn off society and everything would go well. I mean, you'd think they were fundamentalists and had never studied economics, politics, or sociology. Anyway, so creation and providence go together. God creates all things, but he sustains all things. He provides for that, and much of the provision comes through the work that human beings do. But it's also the case, I mean, the interconnectedness of nature. For instance, if you've ever seen The March of the Penguins and the way that that part of the creation, the created order operates, who would design it that way? Well, God would. But if you think about the relationship between birds and bees and pollination and all this stuff, it's just an incredibly complex world out there that God uses all those secondary causes to sustain his creation and his people. But I think you can also see this even in the life of Christ himself. And I was privileged to be in Northern Ireland a few years ago and heard a great sermon about Luke 8. So if you turn there, the initial verses of Luke 8, this has not come from my own insight, but it does make the point that I'm trying to get across here about the importance of work and our dependence on not only our own work, because that provides means for us to live and sustain ourselves, sustain our families, but then also the way in which we depend upon the work of others, because none of us, well, maybe most of us are probably not in the petroleum business. So if we had to go out and get our own gas and have that whole system, that would be a lot of work. Well, believe it or not, there are businesses that provide that for us. Hey, isn't that great? But so we depend on the work of others in all sorts of ways. But Luke 8, the beginning there, you have this account of Jesus and more women. Soon afterward, he went on through the cities and villages proclaiming and bringing the good news of the kingdom of God. And the 12 were with him, and also some women who had been healed of evil spirits and infirmities. Mary, called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had gone out, and Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's household manager, and Susanna, and many others, and this is the key phrase, who provided for them out of their means. Jesus and the 12 didn't do a lot of work as far as producing things. Paul was a tent maker as he was ministering at different times, and he had to engage in work to help support himself. Jesus depended on the work of others to provide for him, it seems. This is one clear instance where he did. Okay, he was a carpenter. Maybe he saved up. Had a lot of, I don't know, but still, Jesus wasn't his calling, like the calling of our pastor, isn't to work in that way, to do stuff that pays money. His work is to do something else spiritual. So this is another way in which even our Lord depended on the work of others, the human activity of others, that say, the medieval church would have regarded as somehow lesser than what the work of monks was in the monasteries.
Is this my last point? I think it is, yeah. And we are getting close to the hour.
So this ties back then to the theme of worship and to think about ways in which work, which is crucial to our existence as human beings and part of how God designed us and the world. But this work then glorifies God. I mean, we've already had a taste of that glorification or how our work glorifies God in Psalm 8, where you have this amazing creation, and then there are human beings plunked in the middle of that, and they have this work to do. And that's also pretty amazing, all things considered, in the whole scope of the whole created order. And I think sometimes we forget about the way in which that work can glorify God in the creation sense, not in the redemption sense necessarily. Of course, as Christians and being redeemed, we can sanctify our work and try to use it directly to say, I'm serving God in doing this. And you're recognizing your creator and redeemer in doing your so-called secular work. Whereas non-Christians who do work that we also value, they also point in some way to the glory of God by the kind of work that they're doing, because they were also created to work like that. And we need those people as well for gas and all sorts of things. Not to say that all people engaged in the petroleum business are unchristian. I'm not any way implying that. But I'm sure that not everybody in the petroleum business is Christian. So we do need those people to do that work. The work that human beings does glorify God. And Christians have the added advantage of being able to do this in an explicit way. So I think we have to keep in mind and make distinctions between the good works we are called to do as the fruit of sanctification. Say, for instance, Peter writes, 2 Peter 1 talks about virtue, diligence, temperance, patience, knowledge, godliness, kindness, charity. Those would be all virtues that we might associate more with sanctification. Paul writes about discretion, chastity, domesticity, obedience, sobriety, and righteousness in Titus 2, for instance. So there's a long and good chapter in our Confession of Faith, chapter 16, about the nature of good works and how a good work qualifies as a good work, and also a recognition that even those good works are still soiled by the sinfulness that remains in us. But just to keep in mind even, I guess, this distinction between creation and redemption, I'd ask, which of these should I use for the sake of time? I guess turn to Leviticus 23, if you would. Verse 9. We were talking about this yesterday with church calendar, and this is in the midst of prescriptions for different holy days that the Old Testament church was to observe, and we don't observe that calendar anymore. The point was, because Christ has fulfilled the Old Testament, so we are now free from that church calendar, and we don't have a church calendar to replace it other than one day in seven, the Lord's Day. For us, the first day of the week. But notice here, with all this instruction about this holy day, how much ordinary activity needs to go on to do it. So, verse 9, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel, say to them, when you come into the land that I give you and reap its harvest, you shall bring the sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest, and he shall wave the sheaf before the Lord so that you may be accepted. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. And on the day when you wave the sheaf, you shall offer a male lamb and a year old without blemish as a burnt offering to the Lord. And the grain offering with it be 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil, and a food offering to the Lord with a pleasing aroma. And the drink offering with it shall be of wine, 1/4 of a hin. And you shall eat neither bread nor grain, parched or fresh, until the same day, until you have brought the offering of your God. It is a statute forever throughout the generations in all your dwellings. So this is a religious prescription. This is instruction about how to be holy before the Lord, to observe this holiday. But notice how much stuff, work in the world, is involved in it. To have the grain, to have the wine, to have the sheep, even perhaps to have the instruments of measuring things, requires a lot of work that goes on in just the ordinary world in order to sustain these religious activities. So even here, we have electricity, we have people who made these pews, we have the construction people who made... You can't ever really just enter into some kind of sacred thing as long as we're in bodies, as long as we're in creation. There's a lot of work that has to go on to sustain even the work of the church in its holiness, meaning its set-apartness. So, again, I think it's really important to distinguish between creation and redemption. But it's also the case that a lot of the work of redemption relies upon the work of creation, sustaining even our bodies so that we can be of health and strength to come to worship and sit under the preaching of the word, to hear with our physical ears, to read with our physical eyes, to taste with our mouths, to touch with our hands, the elements. These are all things that are part of this created order that, again, I guess sometimes I worry that in emphasizing the spiritual character of the Christian life, which is useful to do, especially in conservative Presbyterian circles, when liberalism lost sight of the supernatural and redemptive character of things and went more for a liberalized or social understanding of Christianity. As important as it is to recognize the spiritual nature of things, it's also, we can't lose sight of the created order and our dependence upon it. And I think that's especially useful for thinking about our vocations and work in the world and how we can glorify God by doing it. And I'll stop there. There's about 4 minutes before the coffee hour. If there are any questions, comments? Yes. Yeah, I do have thoughts about it, I like Rod Dreher. I'm actually jealous. I have to confess my sins at times, being how he's been able to hit the mark on these books that sell really well. I've spent a little time with Rod, and he's not nearly as impressive in person as he is in print, but. Hope he's not listening. I doubt that he will be. The difficulty with this, and I think people have criticized him for this. But one, Benedict option is not a way to save salvation, because if you're going to be chaste, you're going to be like the Shakers. The Shakers were this weird group of Quakers who eventually they didn't reproduce. That was one of the conditions of being a member. They wouldn't have sex. If you don't reproduce, you're not going to save civilization. You're going to die. So the monastic, a Benedictine monastic kind of option, his larger point about withdrawing, I think, has some merit to it. And I would argue that J. Gresham Machen had a kind of Machenian option when he decided that maybe we needed to opt out of the mainline Presbyterian church, found an alternate seminary like Westminster, found a different board for foreign missions, and eventually found a new communion. That's kind of Benedict. I think that's also what Dreher was sort of calling for, that Christians need to leave mainstream institutions to set up their own rival institutions. So there's a sense in which I think Dreher is right, but there's also a sense in which I don't think he saw clearly that civilization prior to, say, 2015 was maybe even hostile to Christianity then. And so that leaving, forming separate institutions may have been necessary well before the most recent tumult in our time. But it's worth reading, considering. Rod's always worth reading. Yes. Right, Rod Dreher, the writer of that, who writes at the American Conservative and wrote books like Crunchy Cons and... right. There's another one that was really kind of hit the bestseller list. Anyway, the Benedict option is basically things have become so hostile in the world to Christians that they may need to retreat, probably do need to retreat, and form separate communities like Benedict did with his monastery at Nursia, I guess it was, something like that. So that's sort of the model. He's invoking this older monastic option.